From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Rubin, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, Donald Trump promised to drain the swamp, but so far he's expanded it. We've seen nepotism, conflicts of interest, self-dealing, and lots of lying. And we're not even a year into the presidency. Is Trump going to make Washington even sleazier? Where is the congressional oversight? Do Americans care if the president is making money off his office? That's coming up on 1 year later after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post. Here is Donald Trump on the campaign trail in October of 2016.
Real change also means getting rid of the corruption in Washington, D.C.
That was then, but now that Trump is in office, he's beset by claims of financial wrongdoing, conflicts of interest, and self-enrichment. To help us unravel that, we have Austin Evers, a lawyer in the State Department in the Obama administration. He's now executive director of the Ethics and Transparency Group, American Oversight. Welcome, Austin.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Your group, American Oversight, has sent out more than 500 public records requests to 30 government agencies. What were you looking for and what did you find?
Put simply, we're looking for corruption because we think it's there. And we've had a pretty good record of proving it so far. Excuse me. You know, one of the first things that we were able to do using a Transparency Act known as the Freedom of Information Act was prove that Donald Trump lied about being wiretapped at Trump Tower. We followed that up by proving that Jeff Sessions lied when he was interviewed by the FBI about his Russia contacts. And then we followed that up by proving that Scott Pruitt spends his days at the EPA meeting with lobbyists instead of environmentalists. And, I mean, you put each one of those pieces together and you have a picture of an administration that is dedicated to either self-dealing, dishonesty, or at least giving the government away to the regulated.
He was supposed to put all of his businesses in a blind trust. He didn't do that. It's not blind and it's really not a trust. What are the ramifications of that going forward?
I think there are two. I mean, you start with this is the original sin of the Trump administration. He went to the podium in January and declared that he would deal with these conflicts of interest by withdrawing from operational control of the Trump administration. But what he didn't do and what he has never done is take the for sale sign down from his businesses. So he is available to be bought. And you look at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., and it is the place to be seen and to do business with the administration for $27 margaritas and $700 a night rooms. The implication of that is, number one, you don't know who is doing business with the president and what kind of influence they have. The other part is that it sends a terrible message to the administration and to the public about whether ethics matter, and they clearly don't to this president. And that's why I think you see follow-on scandals like private jet travel by multiple cabinet officials at taxpayer expense. It's like they have no moral compass because their leader doesn't.
That seems to be the rule of the administration, doesn't it? Trump says, and some of his supporters say, listen, the voters knew about his businesses and they voted for him anyway. Does that mean everything he's doing has the blessing of voters? And even if they wanted it, what are the legal and the constitutional restrictions that the president is operating under?
So elections have consequences, but I don't think corruption should be one of them. So you can say that the public knew that they elected a businessman, they elected someone who was going to throw sand in the democratic norms of our country. But at the end of the day, there are rules in place to punish corruption. Bribery is still illegal. We're still waiting to see the outcome of some really interesting emoluments clause lawsuits because the founders put into place a fundamental principle that our government should not be corrupted by turning public office into a cash cow.
And emoluments would be those that provision of the Constitution, the emoluments clause, which says that if you're president or you're in a high office, you can't accept monies, things of values from foreign heads of states, foreign governments. That was a concern of the founders about bribery. You have done a lot of legwork, obviously. Your organization and many others like Crew and others are doing really extraordinary work. But isn't Congress supposed to have a role here? Where are they?
So, unfortunately, I think the founders would not recognize the one-party rule of Washington, D.C. that we see today. They envisioned a separation of powers, an independent Congress, an independent presidency that would be adverse to each other, that would check each other. And we're just not seeing that. I don't know whether it's cowardice or just pure power politics or believing so much in tax cuts that you'll look the other way on almost every other issue. But there's no question that the people with subpoena power in Congress, who are the people with real power, are doing very little to hold this president accountable, with the notable exceptions of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which does seem to be pursuing a credible investigation of Russian interference with our election. But you've got Trey Gowdy, the new chairman of the House Oversight Committee, not doing anything on the Trump International Hotel, not doing anything on the use of Mar-a-Lago as the so-called winter White House, not doing really anything on, unfair dealing by other components of the administration. It's a real abdication.
One of the concerns that many of us have on the right or the left, I think, is that he's filling the government with people who are not qualified, not equipped. You found a former Cabana assistant at a country club that he was offered a position in the USDA. What was that about?
Well, I guess I can't really speak to the motivation behind hiring him specifically. We did find out that his qualifications were, to put it lightly, a little thin for government service. But we saw that this is a broader issue, and I think it's probably the cronyism that people expect in Washington run amok. It's campaign assistants, campaign aides getting high-profile jobs. I think the biggest example is probably Lynn Patton, who was notoriously Eric Trump's party planner, got a job as the head of the largest housing and urban development region of the country, which also happens to have jurisdiction over the public housing development that Trump has an interest in. Another example is Sam Clovis, who is a right-wing radio show host, notably not a scientist, nominated to be the chief scientist of the Department of Agriculture. And the only reason we don't see him sitting in that position today is that he got wrapped up in the Russia scandal.
Let's bring into the conversation Brad Heath, an investigative reporter for USA Today, and Kathleen Clark, a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis, where she focuses on legal and government ethics. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there.
Brad, USA Today has done its own remarkable investigations. You reported back in September, for example, dozens of lobbyists and contractors pay the Trump companies for membership in private golf clubs to get access. Who are these people, and how did you find this out?
Sure. I mean, one of the things we've been trying to keep track of is who is paying money to the president, just because we are in these somewhat unusual circumstances. And what we found was that there are a lot of people who are registered as lobbyists, who run industry associations, who run large companies that get large federal contracts, who are paying members of the president's businesses. So they are making payments that benefit him personally. And the other interesting feature of this is that the president visits his golf clubs a lot. He's been there on about a quarter of the days of his presidency so far. So in addition to putting money into the president's pocket, enriching him personally, you get this sort of proximity that doesn't really – there aren't many people who get close to the president in a social setting.
Right.
Now, And it's difficult to figure out. One of our central challenges at USA Today this year has been to figure out who are the president's customers, both at his clubs, the hospitality side of his business, and in the real estate ventures. And it's difficult to figure it out. So we identified most of the members we know about by looking at their golf handicaps.
And how did that work? I heard about that and was kind of surprised. How did you identify them and then tie them back to Trump?
Sure. So there is a website where serious golfers go to register their handicap, and it's meant to be this sort of public thing where you can look up the people you're playing golf with to make sure they're not fudging their scores or something like that. And the way you get on there is to register through a golf club. And we were able to look up all the people who registered through the president's golf clubs. And we were told that you only get to register through the president's golf clubs if you are, in fact, a member. So that brought us to about 4,500 people. And we spent a lot of time looking at the people who are members of the clubs that he has visited in West Palm Beach, in Bedminster, New Jersey, where he's spent a fair amount of time, and in suburban D.C., where he goes on the weekends.
Brad, what are some of the stories that you found? Who are the people who you found, and are they looking for favors, looking for changes in the law or in regulations?
Sure. Well, so I think this is important to say at the outset is we haven't found anybody yet who we think joined the club as a way to curry favor with the president. These are mostly people who've been members for a while. But there are a lot of them who have both proximity to the president and want something from his administration. One is a pesticide lobbyist whose organization helped persuade the EPA not to take additional action on a chemical that the EPA's scientists thought was tied to developmental disabilities and some other health problems. The one that stands out to me was, you know, the president marked his first 100 days in office by going to a wheelbarrow factory outside Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and it turns out that company is owned by a holding company whose president is a member of the Bedminster Golf Club, who happens to play there a lot when the president is visiting, and has another subsidiary that it's a large defense contractor.
Let me bring Kathleen back into the conversation. Kathleen, it seems like you need a scorecard to keep track of the scandals here. We haven't even gotten to Russiagate or nepotism or his kids' conflicts of interest. Is this for the average viewer and the average listener of television news, radio news, just a giant blur?
I think it can be overwhelming. I mean, we have to thank all of the really excellent work by journalists and by non-government organizations who have sussed out and discovered this information, made it available to us. But it can be overwhelming to try to keep track of the not just scores or hundreds, but sometimes it just seems like thousands of different scandals of various size and significance.
Kathleen, is the problem here we don't have enough laws, or is the problem that we've never had a president who has pushed the envelope as far as Donald Trump has done?
I think there's two parts of the problem. One is that in 1989, Congress exempted the president from the conflict of interest statute. Now, all of the presidents since then have acted as though they were bound by that statute. But now we have a president who wants to take advantage of the fact that he is not subject to that law or many other government ethics standards. And so it's a combination of the decision to exempt the president from these standards, and now a president who has embraced that freedom and has really been going on the rampage to use public office for his own private gain.
And Kathleen, you're a lawyer. Do you think if Congress chose to reimpose the coverage of the president, that would be constitutional? Or are there issues about separations of powers and the president's prerogatives that might get in the way there?
It's true that some people have argued that the Congress doesn't have the power, although Congress asserted this in 1962 when it enacted comprehensive ethics statutes, and the Kennedy administration wanted to exempt the president at that point. Congress rejected that version of the statute. So from 1962 to 1989, presidents were bound by this standard. And of course, as I say, even before and after, acted as though they were bound. So, no, I don't believe that the Constitution or separation of powers demands that a president be immune from conflict of interest standards.
I'm talking with Brad Heath, an investigative reporter for USA Today, and Kathleen Clark, a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And we're chatting about conflicts of interest, ethical morass. Brad, one of the concerns that many Americans have is they see not only maybe friends or members of Trump's club getting benefits, but his children are now in high office and they have business interests. Is that a problem? Number one, putting the kids there in the first place, and number two, them perhaps promoting their own private interests while they're on the government payroll, or at least the power of government behind them.
I think whether it's a problem is a subject that's been debated, and I don't know that there's a cut and dried answer to the legal question. There are definitely laws that regulate the space of can you use your government office to benefit your private business if you're a member of the president's staff, something like that. And it's, there are some lines you're not supposed to cross. They're not always easy to discern at the edges, and they're maybe not especially well policed. But yeah, that's definitely among the many issues people have been talking about in this administration, and among the things that are new and different. And one of the things I think we've seen in the course of our reporting on this is there's so much about this administration that is just different, and it's hard to discern what's good and bad because the legal boundaries are so ill-defined and because it's so opaque in a lot of ways, right? So step one in this process is just to figure out how this administration is different and what new things are happening so that people can make a more informed judgment.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more of our conversation. We also want to hear from you, our listeners, to share your perspective. Go to our webpage, kcrw.org/1year later. This is 1 year Later from KCRW. Again, I'm Jennifer Rubin, and this is 1 year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking about government ethics with Austin Evers, Brad Heath, and Kathleen Clark. Austin, we had a head of the Office of Government Ethics, Walter Schaub, resign earlier this year. Do you have confidence that that entity, which doesn't have a lot of staff, doesn't have investigators, is able to keep a track of some of this, is able to police the administration in any reasonable fashion?
Well, they don't have the ability, the jurisdiction to really police the White House. And that's been a fundamental fight that started under Walter Schaub. But what they do have, I think, is the cred right now to ask for disclosures, to force the White House to file financial disclosures, ethics disclosures, recusals, and the like, and then make them public. And that can really start a conversation. And I think Walter deserves a lot of credit for elevating these issues on his way out the door, so that even if you have a less assertive head of the office right now, the mechanisms are in place. The White House has learned that it has to obey at least the bare minimum. And then, you know, folks like you, folks like us can point out issues as they are disclosed.
Kathleen, we raise the issue now of disclosure, but we saw with Wilbur Ross, who is the Secretary of Commerce, that even though he had a disclosure, it was very hard to figure out what it was that he really owned. They use shell companies called LLCs to disguise what they really have. Is that a problem? And if so, what should we be doing about it?
There is a key problem that the Wilbur Ross controversy reveals. And here's what it is. The financial disclosure law requires officials to disclose the names of companies in which they have a financial interest that they own. But it doesn't require them to disclose the business partners of those companies. It doesn't require them to disclose their key clients. From whom are they actually, are those companies getting money? With whom do they have other kinds of financial transactions or even debts? So that's why we didn't know, based on Wilbur Ross's disclosures, that it turns out that he's basically in business with a couple of oligarchs and Putin's son-in-law. So, yes, I believe that our financial disclosure laws do need to be amended to require the disclosure of the ownership of and financial relationships beyond what they're required now.
And we know England has begun to do just that, beginning to outlaw shell companies. Brad, you've also been looking at the Trump properties, the sales, the purchases of these. It seems like about 70% of the purchases at Trump properties, like condos, have been by these secretive shell companies. That's something like 17 times the number of secret buyers in the last 2 years before. What's going on there, and should that concern us?
We don't know what's going on there. Some of my colleagues here have spent a lot of time, 6 months or so, trying to figure out who's behind these shell companies, what they might want. So far, we haven't turned up any evidence of people buying at above market rates or doing things that would overtly seem like they're trying to curry favor with the administration. But it certainly raises that potential. And it goes back to the same fundamental question we have, which is, who is putting money in the president's pocket day in, day out? And it turns out it's really hard to find the answers to that, in part because, you know, millions of dollars of real estate transactions are hiding behind LLCs. That happens a lot in high-end real estate transactions, but most of those sellers are not the president.
I want to change topics ever so slightly. Austin, you've also been looking at the voting commission, which was set up to find some 3 to 5 million voters who the president, without any evidence, claimed had voted illegally. What is happening there, and what are you doing to uncover the workings of that entity?
Sure. Well, you nailed it from the beginning, which is that the commission was quite clearly established to provide cover for one of the more blatant lies we've ever seen about fraudulent votes. The problem for the administration is that there's a law that prohibits whitewashing or bias by these official advisory committees. The law requires that if you're going to put together a commission like this, it has to be balanced ideologically, and it has to operate with transparency. And so far, it's gotten into trouble on both fronts. Several groups have tried to force the commission to turn over its working papers, which it's obligated to do. And the commission has done a poor job of doing that. It got in trouble with the court over it. And then American Oversight represents the Secretary of State of Maine, who is a Democrat. He's on the commission to provide ideological balance. And he has been excluded from participating. They're trying to run it like it's Kris Kobach's voter fraud, project, but they need to listen to him. So he has sued
Kris Kobach, for our listeners, is the current Secretary of State of Kansas. I believe he's running for governor. He's been involved in a lot of these cases and has actually been sanctioned by some courts for misrepresenting facts.
Yeah, and so I guess the fundamental point here is that there's been a project, primarily on the conservative side, for a long time to prove up voter fraud as a fundamental problem. They've run into some pretty serious factual problems doing that. And what they're trying to do with this commission is give the stamp of legitimacy of the entire federal government to that project. My client, Secretary Dunlap, is trying to bring the kind of balance to this project that will, you know, prevent them from putting out fake news, frankly, about voter fraud. And he's had to go to court to enforce his right.
We have a lot of liberal groups who have ties to the Democratic Party, CREW, others that are pursuing these issues. Is there a danger here that people will perceive this as partisan, ironically, rather than see that they have to do it because the Republicans in Congress aren't doing their job? What's your take on that, Kathleen?
I think that you raise a good point. Congress's failure to really provide a check on the executive branch on this ethics front presents a challenge. And so the non-governmental groups like CREW and American Oversight and many others are really stepping into the breach with the great assistance of terrific reporting. But I think that you also are correct that it's important that those groups both be and be perceived as not being partisan, that they're not in the pocket of either party or a candidate or an elected official. And so I think that that is what you see if you look more carefully at some of these groups, that they actually do toe the line of being nonpartisan.
Kathleen, we talked earlier about the one party, if you will, government that has seemed to have confounded the founders' best laid plans. So we now have Congress, instead of checking the executive, either shrugging their shoulders or enabling them. Did the framers underestimate partisan loyalty and not account for that as they were trying to develop a system of checks and balances that was supposed to block exactly this kind of corruption that we've been talking about?
I think your summary of the historical situation is accurate, that the founders had in mind this idea that ambition of the Congress, of the legislative branch, would check the ambition of the executive branch. But what we have seen in really the last 20 years is that when both the presidency and when both the executive branch and the legislative branch is controlled by the same party, certainly now, Congress has failed to provide the checking function that the founders envisioned or believed that it would. In other words, the founders didn't anticipate the party system and how that would diminish the ambition of Congress in checking the executive.
We're talking today about government ethics with Austin Evers, Brad Heath, and Kathleen Clark. Brad, we've also seen a parade of permanent civil service people go out the door at the State Department, at EPA, at other places. Have those people brought with them information, quite frankly, that is helpful to uncovering some conflicts, that are people who have an insider's view of that bureaucracy that they've come from?
I think that's always been the case in Washington, that people leave their jobs with sometimes with grievances and are happy to talk about them. And there's certainly no shortage of people in Washington these days who want to talk about what's going on in the halls of government.
Right. At least at the State Department, it seems that we've also had a lot of unfilled positions. Trump has said something like, I don't need all these people. I alone can take care of this. As a matter of good governance, which is slightly different than corruption, Austin, is this a problem long term for the government to operate in an effective, efficient, fair-minded way?
I think I'll start by saying I think it's a tragedy at the State Department. I was really blessed to get to work with the Foreign Service and the Career Civil Service there for a couple of years. And they're extraordinary people. These are people who study the world, study languages, and they are on the front lines every single day promoting American interests and really, protecting us. And it will cause severe damage to our country if we are not managing our global presence as well as we can. And it is fundamentally foolish to think that someone can read the international section of a newspaper and become the diplomat to the world. We rely on these people. They are brilliant. They are nonpartisan. And I think it will be one of the deepest scars that this presidency leaves.
Ironically, this happens, of course, at a time where we're overwhelmed with foreign threats. So it would be nice to have some of those people around with that institutional knowledge and background. Kathleen, where do we go from here? If you had your magic wand, would you be passing new laws? Would you be trying to cajole Congress into doing their oversight job with the existing laws? What do you think we should be doing?
What we need is a Congress that will act in conformity with the vision of the founders and act in order to, frankly, protect the republic, which means provide that checking function. But in the meantime, what we need is partly what we have seen, which is the public getting quite exercised on these ethics issues and on other issues to spur Congress to take action. In other words, we have had much more engaged citizenship, I think, since January 20th of this year, and we need to continue that until the next election and until we have a different regime, frankly, a regime that goes back to the and is consistent with and loyal to the principles of our government.
And Brad, that raises an interesting issue. What's been the feedback that you've gotten from readers? Do they appreciate what you're doing? Are you getting the hate mail from the Trump people saying fake news, fake news? What's been your response?
Hate mail, hate voicemail, hate email, hate tweets. Hey, I mean, it's wonderful. It's interesting to me that it's all over the map, right? We get a lot of feedback that's, why don't you investigate Hillary Clinton? And we get a lot of feedback that, you know, impeach him now, and it's everything in between. And, I keep coming back to this idea that people can make up their own minds about what we look at that is or isn't a big deal, but you can't honestly decide that until you know what's actually happening, until you know who is putting in money in the president's pocket and what they want. You really can't have an informed opinion about whether that's good or bad.
And Brad, one, if we're cynical, would say that part of Trump's attack on the free press is precisely because there are people out there digging away. Are you feeling heat from the White House? And if so, does that affect you guys in any way?
It hasn't affected us at all. I mean, it's frustrating to ask a question and get non sequiturs, right? So when we asked about the president's interactions with members at his golf clubs, you know, we were referred to the Secret Service because they handle questions about security. And, these are legitimate questions that we want the answers to because we think our readers want the answers to. But there hasn't been, nobody so far has persuaded us that we should just stop digging at this. And there is an enormous amount of resources, both in the media and in sort of NGOs, that have been kicking the tires on the president's businesses, the president's charity, for 2 years now. We've learned a lot, and we've learned that there's a lot more to learn.
After Watergate, which was the quintessential government scandal, we had a slew of government reforms, mostly in the campaign ethics area. Do you think, from your perspective, Austin, that we're going to see more of this now, that there will be a day, one day, when Trump is no longer president, that we're going to get some serious reforms? Or do you think this is just going to all get shoved under the rug?
So I don't have any insider insight here, but we saw last year when Trump did it, that campaigning on anti-corruption has salience with the voters. And I would not be surprised if during the next couple of election cycles, we see people running on a platform of sincere corruption reform. I think it's necessary. I think there will be an appetite for it. And I think everybody may be swimming in these details, the little scandals, the scandalets, the misuse of public funding here, the hotel there. The picture is forming of a tapestry of corruption that I think people are going to want to tackle. And I think there will be an appetite to push for it. And I certainly hope so.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to all my guests for a terrific discussion. Austin Evers, Brad Heath, and Kathleen Clark. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with One Year Later from PRI. I'm Jennifer Rubin, back with One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show when we talk it out, when we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the right, we're bringing in David Korn. He is the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones and our voice from the left today. Hi, David.
Hey, Jennifer. It is great to be with you, although, as you know, in the last year, we've often agreed more than we've disagreed.
That's absolutely true. So this is a weird out-of-body experience for both of us, I am sure.
Yes, it is.
Today, you wrote a story about Eric Prince. Who is this guy, and what's his relationship with the Russia investigation?
Well, he is a very intriguing person. People have been writing and following him since the Iraq War days. He used to run a company, kind of notorious, named Blackwater. Private military contractors, fancy name for mercenaries, and they did a lot of work in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And in 2007, they were involved in a major controversy where Blackwater contractors in Baghdad ended up having a shootout in a square in downtown Baghdad, and a number of civilians were killed. It seemed like a reckless act, and several were tried back here in the United States. And that really gave Blackwater a black eye, and Prince went on to form different companies, sort of renaming them one after another to try to get out from under that bad reputation. He ended up moving to the United Arab Emirates in 2010 and basically built an entire mercenary army for the emir there. That's where he's been, where he has lived since 2010, but he's been very active in American conservative or right-wing or alt-right or Steve Bannon-type politics, whatever you want to call that. He was a very big Trump supporter, and throughout the campaign, he went on Breitbart Radio and other places and pushed the most toxic and noxious anti-Hillary conspiracy theories. He then sort of mysteriously played a role in the transition, the Trump transition. And I should note that his sister happens to be a woman named Betsy DeVos. Who's that? You know her as the education secretary who Trump picked. They're both from a very, very, very wealthy family. But he comes into the Trump-Russia scandal because in January, according to a Washington Post story, he met in Seychelles, an island in the Indian Ocean, in this sort of secret meeting set up by the United Arab Emirates with a representative of Vladimir Putin to try to create a back-channel communication between Trump and Russia. That's the story. It seems that some of this got picked up by U.S. intelligence and the FBI. They've been investigating. And so he's being called into the House Intelligence Committee for a meeting, a questioning session tomorrow. It's behind closed doors. Public won't get to see it. But I think they want to know more about this attempt to set up a Trump-Russia back channel, Trump-Putin back channel, something that he denies he did. He doesn't deny that the meeting. He says the meeting was not about this.
This is not.
That makes it.
Yeah, this is not the only back channel setup that we are familiar with. It seems that the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was also interested in setting one of these things up. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what makes this really interesting. We see during the campaign and after the campaign, the transition period, numerous attempts in Trump's circle to sort of get a private communications link or relationship directly with Putin or his office. So as you noted, in December, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who's now one of his top advisors, met with Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the United States, and tried to set up a private communications, even to the extent that he suggested, well, maybe you can let me come into the embassy, the Russian embassy, and use their secret communications so we can talk directly to Putin. This is completely nuts. I can just imagine the ambassador saying, what? Is this for real? Are they trying to, get in and, and spy on us? We know during the campaign, numerous Trump people try to reach out to Russians, including Kislyak and others, either to try to get those mythical Hillary Clinton emails or something else. And to me, one of the most intriguing things is that Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, told your fine newspaper, the Washington Post, last February, that he had conversations with Michael Flynn, who is then Donald Trump's top national security advisor, before Election Day, during the campaign. Now, this was at a time when Flynn and others, and us, knew that Russia was attacking the election and hacking the election. So my question is, what was Flynn doing talking to Kislyak while the Russians and the Putin regime were attacking the United States? We still don't have an answer to that.
Right. And the president keeps talking about this whole Russia investigation wrapping up by the end of the year. I don't see it. And I fear that these statements predicting the end of it are designed really to set up his supporters to attack and demand that the investigation get shut down. We're going to shift to topics here a bit and talk about Trump's latest outrage. You have to keep up minute by minute. But he retweeted this morning some controversial Muslim videos and got rebuked by the British Prime Minister Theresa May. Earlier today, the White House defended Trump's retweets. Let's hear from its press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Regardless of the video, the threat is very real. The president has talked about the need for strong borders and strong security since the campaign trail. That's not a secret. That's something he's going to continue talking about and continue highlighting in a lot of different venues and avenues.
Regardless of whether these things are true, is really that the best defense that they can come up with for this?
Yes. Yes, it is the best defense they have. I mean, you know, what we've seen is, you know, Trump has been a racist. It's a big word to use, and I understand that. I try not to be overly pejorative, but he's been racist, you know, for decades, but certainly in his current political career. He started out by pushing the
Muslim ban.
The birther conspiracy theory, and maybe this is somewhere where I can get some disagreement with you, Jennifer, because I hate agreeing with you so much.
Yeah, I know.
But I do think, when he first started doing that, Republicans did not shun him. They accepted him. Even, you know, Mitt Romney in the 2012 election, I know you're a big fan of him, and he's a fine man in a lot of ways, but he went after Donald Trump's endorsement, accepted it when Donald Trump was in full birther mode. And I think that let Trump into the Republican tent, in which he's now had a hostile takeover. So he's been doing this from the beginning. And what happened this morning is just so dismaying. You have David Duke delighted in Trump's tweets. You have Britain First, which has been called a racist, fascist group, saying, look at us. We've been tweeted by Donald Trump. We're normalized. And that's what he's doing. And, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the rest of the Republican Party, and especially those who say nothing, are normalizing and enabling Trump to do this and to make really the promotion of racism and violence a part of the Republican, you know, project. It's really quite disheartening to see. And I know you speak out against things like this, but elected Republicans, you know, only a handful are. They just kind of turn their head because all they really seem to care about is getting the tax cut bill through.
I hate to disappoint you, David, but I'm going to agree with everything you just said.
Oh,
once again,
darn
I know.
It.
Darn it. Today, we also saw from the New York Times a report that Trump is still clinging to birtherism, thinks he won the women's vote, says it's not really him on the Access Hollywood tape. Is he nuts or is this just more lying?
You know, I raised this repeatedly during the campaign, and you know, it was hard to get. He was such a spectacle, you know, on cable news and everywhere. People just loved the showmanship, but he would say things too on TV, campaign rallies that just seemed to be so far removed from the truth. I really think we can't discount what I think is a strong possibility that he has delusional tendencies. I still remember the day of the inauguration. He went out to the CIA, and not only the stuff about the inauguration crowds, but he went on and kept saying how he's been on more Time magazine covers than anybody else, which was not even close to true. He just talks about himself. He really seems to not have any curiosity about actual facts, but he talks with some degree of conviction about these issues that are just completely contradicted by the facts.
Right.
And people just seem to let him get away with it, the ones around him. They kind of try to figure out how to move him on to a different subject.
And that would be two concerns that I have, David. One is that there are people who apparently think this is amusing. Senator Perdue of Georgia thought this was all a laugh riot, according to the New York Times, and that they're running around trying to get people to get him off these topics. And the second is, perhaps we really do have a 25th Amendment problem here. That's the amendment that would allow a president to be removed if he can't function. I've been opposed to that, going down that route, but I'm coming around to the conviction that if he really is not functioning on all cylinders and can't tell reality from fantasy, maybe we are getting close to 25th Amendment territory.
Well, I really don't like being alarmist, but you get to a situation where you have a North Korean missile that can go farther, seems to be able to go farther than we thought. I don't want, overstate that, but it seems to be becoming more of a threat. You have a guy who seems to want to rattle the cage and, you know, and create a heightened state of tension, and a person who may not be able to tell fact from fiction. And so I'm still waiting for somebody, you know, one of these so-called adults who, you know, we talk about in the administration, to come out and tell us the damn truth. The ones who, you know, call him a moron and say he's dumb or out of touch, you know, privately, to have the guts to come forward, and if they believe this, to say it to the American public, which might lead to the type of discussion that you reference about the 25th Amendment. I mean, there can't be anything more serious. I mean, this is even bigger than tax cuts.
There you go.
Have a guy in charge of nuclear weapons who may not be all there.
We're going to have to wrap it up, David. Obviously, we have much more to talk about, but that's it for today. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show with Bill Kristol on conservatives finding their inner feminist and socialist. 1 Year Later is a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International. We leave you with Money, Money, Money from ABBA.
PRI, Public Radio International.